Hey, everybody. Welcome back to another edition of the Mundane Festival podcast. I'm your host, Chris Lambert. Today is Tuesday, June 23rd, 2020. Remember, as always, you can subscribe to the show on Apple Podcasts, Stitcher, Spotify, and on Podbean, the host site. If you like this show, please rate and review it on Apple Podcasts and or Stitcher. Give it a 5-star review. Let everyone know why you like it, because it will make me feel good about myself and most of the life decisions that I've made so far. You can email the show at mundanefestivalpod@gmail.com. Let me know what's on your mind. More importantly, what's on your heart. You can like the show on Facebook. You can follow it on Twitter at Mundane Festival. And you can follow me, your host, the guy talking to you right now, on Twitter at Chris Lambert. This is episode 432. I have a super special brand new guest, comedian, actor, podcaster, Justin Brown from the Medium Popcorn Podcast. I'm going to share that conversation that I had with him, with you, in a couple of minutes. Right now, I just want to do some house cleaning, talk to you for a little bit, a scotch, if you will. Last week was pretty eventful. The Last of Us Part 2 came out, and I'll talk about that in a bit. But it was a really great way to close out the week. Not only did I get a great video game to play on Friday, I got to do my first Zoom comedy theme show, Drunk Black History, which was hosted by Brandon Collins and Gordon Baker Bone. It was so much fun. I went to a live show that they did in February, Black History Month edition, and I had so much fun. And I was like, man, I want to do that one day. And I actually got the chance to do it via Zoom, and it was so much fun. It was so cool. They had, I think Brandon said maybe they had 100+ people. I don't know if it was, you could almost say that was sold out to a certain degree. I know he tweeted that day, can you sell out a comedy show on Zoom? But I don't know. Whatever it was a huge success. I bought a really nice bottle of some Woodford Reserve double oaked bourbon whiskey. The last time I got a bottle of that, it was probably, it might have been New Year's, like 5 or 6 years ago. I don't really drink that much, but I said, if I'm going to drink, I want to have a good adult beverage to go with. And I didn't eat that much that day. I was just excited. I was up on adrenaline. So The Last of Us Part 2 downloaded at, it was live at 12 o'clock Eastern Standard Time for me. And I think I might have played it until 4 a.m. And then I woke up and I started playing it again, and then cut it off, and then went out to the store and did Drunk Black History. I didn't play anymore after that. But then I didn't really eat anything. I had some chips and I had a couple of these beers, like this Cape May Brewing Company, or Cape May, I think it's Cape May Brewing. Yeah, Cape May Brewing Company. I thought I'd check that out. I did a show down in Cape May, New Jersey, maybe like 2 or 3 years ago. Not too long ago. Might have been 3 years ago, Mother's Day weekend. And I think that's that episode where I recorded from a bed and breakfast, which used to be a slave house, a slave mansion. Used to be on a plantation. So that was fun. So I said, oh, Cape May Brewing. The cans look decent. They look cool. I'll check it out. I had a great time doing that. So thanks again to, and shout out to Brandon Collins, Gordon Baker Bone, and Brandon's lovely wife, Tati. She produced the show, and it was so much fun. That was great. And The Last of Us Part 2, I took off 2 days of work. I had been grinding for like 3 months since the the pandemic hit and never really like came up for air. And I said, this would be a perfect time to just take a couple days off, take that Friday off and the Monday to try to finish the game. And I got stuck at one part on, I think that was Sunday. And then I just wish my dad a happy Father's Day, had a nice moment. I think that was, yeah, like on Sunday, and plowed through to like, God, I might have talked to him at 9. And then I got stuck at like 6 o'clock. I was going through that fucking game. It's so much fun. It's not for everybody. I know you've heard me rave about this game for years now. The first one, and then my anticipation, it was basically 7, really at the most technically was 7 since the first one came out, but you could say 6 years when they announced it. They announced it in 2016, so that's at least four years of waiting for this game. And it really didn't disappoint me. I'm gonna hopefully get my buddy Tajay Moment, great YouTuber doing his thing, on the rise, killing it with his channel. I want to get him on and do like a spoiler cast and just kind of break stuff down. He was on the show last fall around October, and we just talked about our predictions and what we thought. I think we had a couple things right about the mystery woman who, you know, I won't spoil for anybody that's, but anyway, I'm going to try to get him back on and shoot the shit with him, talk about the game and really get his analysis on, and then talk about his journey, because he's another person who I feel like has gotten the mundane festival bump. That's just me just trying to big the show up a little bit, but it's not to say that he doesn't have talent and is not doing his thing on his own, but I still will say mundane festival bump. Awkwafina did it. Awkwafina got the mundane festival bump. Quite a few people have. So I'm, you know, whatever. Anyway, but I really had I was just locked in, and I've never been this excited for a video game. I don't think. I'm trying to remember when I was a kid what it might have been. Maybe like a Madden, but just like that overall feeling that I've talked about a number of times on the show. And like, you go to Toys R Us, you go to the toy store. Like, there's certain moments. I remember when my dad called around to get, I think it was Bulls versus Blazers in the NBA playoffs for Sega Genesis. And he took me down to Falls Church, Virginia, to Toys R Us to get it. And like, yeah, we got him in stock. And we went down, and just like, that was a great fucking moment. That was a great time. I remember being excited about, I was in grade school. I was still at St. Francis, going to school in D.C. So I remember being excited about Play Action Football for Nintendo. That didn't even have real teams. And it was so, if you go on YouTube and look that up, it looks so archaic. That was an exciting time. G.I. Joe. Getting G.I. Joe for Nintendo was a big one, too. I remember making the honor roll. I was smart. I don't know what happened now, but I was smart back then. And I made the honor roll. And my dad took me to Iverson Mall. And I think KB Toy Store used to be in Iverson Mall. I want to say it was. If it wasn't, we may have gotten it from Toys R Us. But I remember in the same week, if not the same day, I got the G.I. Joe video game. And I want to say I got another Bad Creations album on a tape. It was a tape. I remember I think I got it from Kent Mill Records. D.C., Maryland people know what I'm talking about. I do remember certain instances about getting excited about games, but like, it, whatever, either way, it wasn't like this. And I never splurged for a collector's edition, and I posted pictures on IG and Twitter. I don't know if you can sell this stuff on eBay. I don't know how. I've never done that, but I got the Ellie edition, and as soon as it came out, everything was sold out. The Ellie edition was sold out, and I was able to get the collector's edition, and then they did a restock in February, so now I had both. I had the Ellie edition come from GameStop, and then I pre-ordered the collector's edition from Best Buy. So they both came through, and then because I was too pressed, I got the digital version because I knew I would have it as soon as it was released. So, yeah, I was really stoked for this, and it didn't disappoint. My only thing is I wish that I didn't let myself get spoiled. I should have been a little more diligent, but after about two delays, I was just kind of like, I got to see something. You got to show me something about this game. I cannot be in the dark. Some of the spoilers weren't, a lot of the spoilers weren't true. There was some footage that was shown, but it was taken out of context. It was just really gameplay, and you don't really know what's going on. And then the subtitles were foreign languages, so you kind of didn't know what was going on. There was Reddit stuff. There was all this crap. But overall, it was such a great experience that I wanted to just, like, get through. And I even though I really enjoyed it, I felt like I was at like a race against the clock because I didn't think I would fully get to enjoy it if I was just like, part of me, I don't know. Part of me just wishes that low key. I wish that I didn't care as much because maybe I wouldn't have gotten spoiled like some of my other friends that weren't as obsessed with me that were healthy about it. Yeah, but overall, I still just really enjoyed the game. But I will say at the same time, just because I like it, it doesn't mean you're going to like it. But I thought the first one was terrific. This one is really good. This is really just like, it's almost like two games. It's two games. It is two games. And it's Sony and it's Naughty Dog, the studio behind the game, that really pushed the game, the system, the PS4 to the limit, like the last one did, like part one did for the PS3. So I just felt like overall, just my review was just like, I felt like Naughty Dog took all the great things that they learned from the Uncharted series and the first Last of Us and Left Behind, the DLC, and put it into this game, and it became like, I think it's an epic experience. I think I'm still trying to wrap my brain around it. I just beat it yesterday, but I really enjoyed it. And it's not a, they did say, I think Neil Druckmann, the code, one of the director, the VP of Naughty Dog was basically saying it's not a fun game, but I would say the gameplay is way better than the first one. The graphics are beautiful. It's the most beautiful game that I've ever played. Horizon Zero Dawn is up there. The Last Guardian's up there for me. I've mentioned that. That's kind of like a, it's a AAA title. Is it a AAA title? I don't know. But it's not as highly regarded as like a God of War or Spider-Man. But it's a beautiful game. It is really violent. There was a kid I was going back and forth with a guy that I went to high school with, just talking about, you know, pre-orders versus physical copies, blah blah blah. And then this one kid from North Carolina looked like he just kind of like jumped in and like was like, oh yeah, I heard it was great, it looks great and all this stuff, but he's a kid, so I don't know if it's really for him. But when I was, I don't know, the games didn't look like this when I was a kid. So all that violence, man, I don't know. But yeah, overall, I had a great weekend. It was like kind of like a delayed 40th birthday present, even though I had a great time, like having a get together with some friends and comics and all that stuff. This was like my birthday present. So this was like my official birthday present weekend. I don't know, like 4 months later, I would say. Even though I still had a great birthday weekend, but this was like The Last of Us was supposed to come out on my birthday, and I could see where all the my bank account was kind of dwindling. I'm okay. I'm not poor, but it's like the stuff when you pre-order it, that shit just like, it's like, oh God. But it was worth it. It was so much fun, and I can't wait to hopefully get Tajay back on the show and just really break it down with somebody that really knows his shit and really appreciate that dude's opinion. So that's that. Let's just get you to Justin. Justin Brown, I've known for a few years. I've known him at least like 4 or 5 years, I want to say. I met him through Brandon doing their show, Grits. They used to do a variety show in, I believe the Gramercy area, I want to say, but in Manhattan, in New York City. And I met him a while ago. It's always a dude that I always enjoyed being around, doing Medium Popcorn with him and Brandon, and just shooting the shit with him every time I see him and get to talk to him. Just all around cool dude. It's like one of those things where it's like I knew him, but I didn't know him. And we were talking. I was like, dude, you got to come on the podcast. We were talking like actually the night of the last live Drunk Black History at Caveat in New York City. I remember he was like, dude, you're like, he's like a really interesting dude. And he shared some stuff in our friend group that I was like, yo, man. We got to lock down a date. So this is just one of these episodes where I really was just like, whoa, he just kind of blew it. Just his story kind of blew me away. It wasn't anything like super sad or harrowing, but just like it's one of those conversations that I already liked the guy, but then I just kind of liked him a lot more after talking to him, after just like learning more about his story and how he came up. And I think that's the beautiful thing about, doing this for me. That's the one of the most rewarding things for me about doing a show like this and getting to talk to these cool and interesting people. So without further ado, let's get to know more about Justin Brown. You have a cat too?
Yeah, man.
I didn't know that. What's that like?
Dude, I mean, listen, man, I've only had, like, I have a Bengal cat.
Uh-huh. I don't know.
Yeah, so it's like, so it basically looks like a little leopard.
Okay.
It's an exotic cat because they're bred off of these Asian leopard cats, which is like these big ass cats. So like these are like after like four generations, you can, you know, have these. And it's like, it's a cross between a cat and a dog. Like he needs to play, like he'll fetch and all that kind of stuff. So it's like having a dog, but in a cat. And just sometimes, you know, because like cats are cats, you know, sometimes he's a dick.
Yeah.
And he's like a hyper intelligent predator. So like he does shit. And I'm just like, yo, come on, man. Like I didn't sign up for this.
So you're like the Black Joe Exotic of cats, house cats.
Pretty much. Wow. Pretty much.
That's crazy. What is it like with the kid, like with your kid around, like having a baby and a cat? Like,
well, it's funny because the cat was the cat was born like almost a year to the date that my son was born.
Oh, okay.
So, like, you know, it's like it's almost like they're brothers, mm-hmm. and like the cat gets tired of his little brother's shit and then wants to bite him. And sometimes, you know, the cat just wants to be an asshole. Then he'll fuck with him because he's trying to walk, and he'll just push him over and shit like that. So it's. But then there's other times where like the cat's laying on the couch, and then my son comes by, and he's like petting him nice, and he's rolling around on his stomach, you know, yeah. Rolling around on his back. So it's like, it's really a mixed bag. You just never know what you're gonna get. Every day is different. It's a different day.
The minute he touched my kid, that fucker would be in a shelter or something.
Yeah, I mean, but I also dropped change in this cat.
I spent a little too much money on this. You got to keep him away from the kid.
Yeah, he's gonna figure that shit out.
I used to like cats when I was a kid. I liked them. I don't have a problem with them. But when I was a kid, I used to spend summers in North Carolina with my aunt and my grandmother. And my aunt used to have, it was like in the country. So we'd have big, you know, big places to play. Field and all that stuff, but they had, she had cats, my aunt did, and they would be like stray cats, and you know, yeah, sometimes
they're free roaming.
Yeah, they were like, I guess now they call them feral cats, but they were around. I got scratched maybe one or two times, but mainly they were pretty adorable. And
well, you know, the thing is, it's just like they're. Cats, in a sense, they're almost like wild hogs because they actually adapt to their surroundings very well. Because like if you have like a pig in captivity or whatever, a pig and a wild hog are exactly the same. But like once you take that pig and you put it out in the wild and it becomes a feral hog, it grows the tusks and like its skin becomes tougher and it like that's where it gets all the hair.
Mm.
So it's the same exact thing. It's just, you know, one's in captivity, one's not. But like the cats are the same thing. So like if he wasn't neutered, he'd be about like 2 to 3 times the size. But these cats, they're like muscle bound cats. So like he's lean. He's very lean right now. But it, like if I never got him neutered, he'd be a monster. And like they will go out, they will hunt, and they're apex predators. It's like that cat is a survivor. If it got out, I really don't have to worry about him, other than the fact is like, you know, that's my cat that I raised and he's now wandering the streets, but he's going to survive.
So not only are you like Joe Exotic, you're kind of like Marc Maron too. The black Marc Maron. Cause you have a podcast. We'll talk about that too. I kind of had this disconnect, I guess, ever since maybe since I was 10, and then I just never had that around any like at post that time. And then I've always liked dogs. Like JL has a dog that, you know, when I would do podcasts with him, his dog Cookie would be there and stuff. And it's a sweet dog, but there is a certain kind of a disconnect that I have with animals. I respect them a little too much. I think I respect.
Yeah, I feel
you. Yeah, you never know what's going to happen.
See, like my thing is like I've always been a dog person, and I would still say I am a dog person. But like, so I had a Rottie lab for 13 years, and then he passed away. And I mean, like I love that dog. Like when I had to put him down because he just got too old, and I took him to the vet. You know, the vet put him to sleep, and I carried him home, and I buried him in my yard.
Damn.
Like, I dug the hole.
How old were you?
Oh, that was 4 years ago.
Fuck, man. Was this in Long Island, or where?
Yeah, that was in Long Island.
So it was the family dog?
Yeah, it was my family dog.
That's got to suck. Do you still miss him?
Dude, here's the crazy thing. Like, that dog, obviously, for 13 years of my life, he was around. But like, he was really, really attached to my dad because my dad had like a guard, turned him like a guard dog and the house dog, or whatever. And like he was a monster. Mm-hmm. Everyone thought, but like he was the sweetest dog in the world. But when my dad was in the hospital, I took my dog there, like, not too long before my dad passed away. Mm-hmm. And my dog just like he was just like, oh my God, here he is, and like laid down next to him. And wouldn't let anybody come by him. He's just like, nah, this is my man right here. My dad passed away. My dog died probably almost a year to the day later, a year later.
Shit.
Yeah, dude. It was a lot at the time. But it was just like, I love that dog so much. But I took years off. I'm just like, I'm not ready for another animal. But then I'm just like, traveling and all of this. I'm just like, I can't have a dog because I don't have the time to put in. So I got the cat because I could put out food for a cat for like 3-4 days, or somebody can just stop by and just feed them something like that, and they're kind of self sufficient. Where a dog, I can't do that.
Right.
And also, I like big dogs because I can get no little foofy dog I gotta take that I can take on the plane with me, shit like that. I'm not about that life.
Yeah, that's interesting. I think I would get too attached, and then I'd just be really fucking sad if it died before me.
Oh yeah. Well, I mean, but that's the thing. It is.
Yeah.
You know, most dogs are gonna, you know, at most are gonna give you about 15 years at most. A cat, this cat's gonna be around for the next, you know, like maybe 25.
Damn.
I mean, I hope I outlive this cat.
Yeah, I hope you do too. Yeah. We don't know with what the fuck's going on now. Like, true. You know, with COVID and you know, being black, maybe they'll lay up off of, maybe the cops will lay off of us for about 3 or 4 weeks. we gotta try to milk all this shit while we can.
Yeah, brother.
How are you doing? Like, I know we talk every now and then. We've been talking and stuff and texting, but what has quarantine been like for you?
Dude, quarantine is just, you know what? I would say I'm in a better position than other people just because, like, I started this job on March 1st, this new job on March 1st. And then, and they're like, okay, you know, everybody, your job is cool. We're just going to switch over to do training online. So I just been doing training virtually for the last 3 months. So that's at least kept me occupied. Yeah. But you know, on the other end, like, yeah, you know, my wife, you know, she was furloughed from her job, up until, you know, maybe 2-3 weeks ago. So it's like it was starting to drive her crazy. Just, you know, she's not using her brain. She's only with the baby. So, and we're in the house for the most of the day and stuff like that. So that's what's kind of started got hard. But now that she's, you know, doing her own thing again, it's like, you know, we at least have our own lives outside of each other.
Sure.
To do things. But it's, you know, being stuck in the house, like, I'm a, you know, I hate this term saying that I'm a people person because we're all people persons.
Yeah.
Because we're people.
Right.
But like, yeah, I thrive on being around people.
Yeah. You
know? So not being able to do that, you know, see new people, meet new people, have these conversations, you know, it's been tough. I mean, Zoom calls help, but it's like there's nothing like, you know, looking into somebody's eyes.
Yeah.
You know? Yeah. So it's like, you know, it's been tough in that sense. But like, I also look at it kind of like, I'm glad that I'm home with my son.
Yeah. Yeah.
So, you know, it's trying to, it's all perspectives, and, you know, my perspective changes every 24 hours.
I agree with you. Mine changes too. Like, I try to be, I'm for the most part positive. I try to, I don't know, is emanate the right word? I try to put that out there for the most part. Not that I'm like, oh, like Pollyanna about my shit all the time, but for the most part, I do that. But I think, like everybody, like, I have my highs and lows. But I do notice when I'm out, when I make interactions with people, I miss it. Like, I miss going out. I miss, like,
yeah, and it enriches your soul.
Yeah, and I'm a homebody. Like, I can be by myself, you know, but that connection, you know, sometimes you at least know, okay, if I don't do shit all day, but I'm doing a set tonight, especially like on a weekend or something. Like, I'm doing a set, I'm not doing shit, but I'm going into the city and going to do a show. Or I'm, you know, you at least get to say, well, I did that thing. Because I'm kind of like that for a person that's like very introvert. You know, that whole introverted extrovert thing where,
well, go ahead. You know what? I think it's just like you're a selective introvert.
Yeah.
You know what I'm saying? Because, yeah, like, you know, sometimes you're going to need your time. So then you can be extroverted and express yourself. But it's like, it's always, you have to manage that in the right way, because if you do too much, you're going to burn out. If you do too little, then you don't feel like, you know, you feel like a piece of you isn't there.
That's true. Because sometimes I'll say to myself, almost like I'm a robot, where I said, I went to that social function and I had a good time. And I did. I did my responsibility as a friend and a human, and that was that. You know, sometimes I have to make myself do that. And like, when I have a, you know, and then I, most of the time I have a really good time. Like, you know, like when you guys all came to my birthday get together in February, like, I was like, man, I'm glad I did that. You know, like, I'm glad that I, like, just, you know, put it out there and say, hey, let's just have a gathering. It doesn't have to be all about me, but it, let's use me as an excuse to
get people together.
Yeah. So like, that's a good memory. And like, going to the Drunk Black History show. That was like probably one of the last things I did, like events. I think I went to that, and then right before the shutdown, I went to Sarah Tolomash taped her album, like I think maybe the week.
Okay.
And I went to that. I was like, yeah, this is that's because that's the stuff that feeds you spiritually. Not only are you connecting with people, but then at the same time, you're inspired by it, you know, like, yep. Like going to, especially seeing your peers and colleagues just like do their thing, you know? So yeah, it's, I miss that too. I miss that.
Sarah Tolomach, she was on my UCB team. She's a writer.
Oh shit. Okay. I love her, man. Like she,
yeah, man, she's really nice. Sweet girl.
She's a sweetheart. She's really funny. And I think I even told her this, like, I think she, you know, needs to like start auditioning for shit, like acting stuff.
You know what? Like in the time that, you know, we were on the team and whatnot, I don't feel like, you know, that's her thing.
Yeah. I don't think she may not want to do it. Like, I think the last time she was on the show, she and I were talking about, she's like, yeah, you know, it didn't seem like a big priority for her, but like some, you know, sometimes you see it in certain people. You see, like,
yeah.
I wonder how I bet this person would be good at like acting. Like if you put them in the right thing, they could really like shine, and it doesn't have to be a big thing.
You know what is funny? Because like if I was casting and I saw Sarah come in, nothing against Sarah or anybody else. It's like, you know, you got to look at age demographics and things like that. I would put Sarah as like that kind of awkward mom.
Yeah.
Awkward. Yeah. That awkward mom who's just like unintentionally hilarious.
Right.
You know what I'm saying? And you know, obviously a certain kind of like, you know, maybe a coming of age movie or something like that. Mm-hmm. Like I could see her as a mom who's just like, I've just had enough of being like, you know, the stereotypical, you know, mom.
Yeah.
And just like, you know, fuck it. I'm just gonna be real with my kids. Like that's what I see that role for her, like so clear. And like, I would hope that at some point she plays that.
Yeah. See what you just did? You cast her already.
Yeah.
That's an indie. That's at least an art house movie. That's like a
100%,
like an 85 minute movie. You know,
yeah.
That's at least that, you know, what have you like? So, yeah, I think it's true, man. I think like regardless, whatever your level is, where, you know, folks have been saying like comedians make the joke or other people will make the joke on Twitter. It's at this, you know, probably like 2 weeks in to quarantine. It was like a stock thing to just say, I've been working on this my whole life, self-quarantining or whatever, all that, you know,
yeah,
all that shit. But it's taking a toll, and I think that's why people are really itching to go out. And it seems like I'm apprehensive about this shit, dude. Like,
what do you mean?
The more stuff opens
back to it,
yeah, man, the more stuff opens up, it's just like, we don't have a vaccine, and I know the economy, we need to get that right, and I want people to go back to work and earn, make money, make a living, but it's still.
But you got to think of it this way: is like everything that's happening right now, this has become our new normal.
Yeah, that's true.
So now, like, you know, as far as like, if you would have told us this is what we had to do 4 months ago, this would have been we would have been dreading this.
Yeah.
But then now that this is a little normal and we've all settled in, because 3 months is a good opportunity to, you know, to figure this shit out. Now it's like, oh, guys, we're going to open back up. And now everybody's just kind of just like, yeah, yeah, I can't wait. And it's like, oh, shit, that's really going to happen now.
Yeah.
So like now, you know, the thing that the thing that you want is always going to be the big monster in your life, because it's the unknown. Because you don't know how it's going to work out,
right?
And which is funny, because I just feel like that's, you know, that's what, you know, acting, that's what comedy is, because you don't know if it's going to work out, and that's why it's scary as hell. If you have anything that you're chasing after, you know, it becomes a monster for you.
That is true. Yeah, it's kind of weird. You think about that every night you get up, you're facing a beast, but then at the same time, you do have some form of control over it. It's a controlled chaos in a lot of ways.
Yeah.
That you try to work through. That's an interesting way to look at it too. Yeah, because you don't think of, I think because we do it so much, we've done it so much where it's just a part of who we are. But then when you, if you look at it on a, like a, you know, like a more macro level, it's like, yeah, this is kind of, it's kind of weird. And I know like performers, especially comedians, we kind of shit on our craft a little too much to like mm-hmm. take the piss out of it, even though it's still, I think it's, you know, I mean, one thing that quarantine has done for me, it made me think, like, is this shit frivolous? Is this pursuit, like, is it bullshit? Even, and then I always come to the conclusion and say, like, not really, because I've met so many cool and interesting people. I'm talking to one of them now, and I've had so many experiences that I've overcome certain fears and apprehensions or whatever the fuck, and I've overcome them and came out on the other side. And then,
now I'll throw this at you though, but the same can be said about anything.
That's true.
Anything and everything is frivolous, and you know, and it's, you know, because when you really come down to, you know, we are here for a finite amount of time, and that time is a blip on a scale.
Yeah,
like we're literally in, you know, the vastness of the universe, time and space. Like we are a speck of dust, you know. But like, you know, regardless, in that speck of dust, that's where our world survives.
Mm-hmm.
And so it's like you have to. It was like, well, you know, if I'm a piece of dust, I'm gonna rock this bitch out as much as I can. I'm gonna get in some motherfucking shorts and scrape his asshole. You know what I'm saying?
Yeah,
it's like,
yeah.
You know, you have to make yourself known. You have to do something. But it's weird because yes, as artists, we always think of ourselves as like, oh, we're, you know, this is a frivolous pursuit and all. But it's like everyone is dealing with that same. With that same mentality on a daily basis, it's just the only thing is like we're sitting around, we're actually consciously thinking about it because part of our job is breaking down the world around us.
That is true, man. Like that I don't think I've heard it said that good. I just feel, you know, it's just like society tells us, you know, what's important, and it's just always like the performing arts is just kind of like. Whatever, but at the same time, everybody's been drawn to the arts, especially in this time. What are you watching on TV? What are you binging? What are you listening to? What kind of music are you listening to? What kind of podcasts are you listening to? So it's, I think, you know, I try to pull like when I know like my peers and colleagues say, well, I just tell dick jokes or blah blah blah. I'm like, no, it's something, you know. You know that I think that's what kind of that pushed me to put out my little EP, because it was like I got to say this is why I was here for a little bit.
There you go.
If the Rona got me, I was here for you know for a little bit, and I did this thing that has a barcode on it, and it'll survive after I'm not here.
See, so I'm going to touch on that, what you just said in a second. I want to go back to one thing you did say before.
Okay. Because
it's like, as artists, you know, like right now, people are, you know, looking to us, you know, for entertainment, for, you know, for in some cases, some wisdom.
Yeah.
You know, and part of that is the fact is like, they don't come to grips with you know our you know reality our mortality as much as we do on a daily basis, because you know in some cases a lot of us are you know really at the bottom end of every the gene pool but like of society,
right,
for so long, and it's like is our voices that people look to uplift them. But I you know with everything going on, the protests and things like that, you know, I was talking to my buddies in the Instagram chat, and I showed the shirt. I bought a shirt by Art by Chuck Stiles,
okay,
of Martin Luther King and Malcolm X standing next to each other, but it was in like they put them in place of Big Boy and Andre 3000.
Oh, I've seen that. Yeah, that's a dope shirt. Yeah.
Yeah. So like I was like, yo, you guys should check out this artist. He's got some really dope stuff. And the dude was just like, he's like, oh, I love the concept. It was like, I don't know how I feel about them being, you know, thrown in kind of like that outcast swing. I said, but when it really comes down to, like, you have to support your artists, mm-hmm. because especially black artists right now for us.
Yeah.
Because when it really comes down to it, you know, with all these protests like that, who are they listening to?
They listen to us.
They listen to artists. That's the only, like, artists are kind of the only voice of black America.
Yeah.
Because the news paints this one way, but like you only get the true kind of skinny from some guys who go out there, men and women who go out there and speak on our behalf for us on these stages, in these songs, you know, through their artwork and things like that. And like, that's the only way we've been seen for centuries.
Yeah.
So it's like this, like, that's why we're so important. Like, we're crucial. Especially, you know, in the realm of, you know, people of color, because, you know, in some cases, it's just the only language that other people will actually understand for us.
Yeah. And I'm going to add a footnote to what you just said. I just retweeted a few hours ago. Wyatt Cenac just tweeted this. He says, black people have been calling out racism for generations. We said it calmly. We shouted it in the streets. We put it in writing. We put it in our music, in our movies, in our shows. We put it on stages, in our art. And you danced and you danced. You laughed, you clapped, but you never heard. That's real shit, man.
For real, for real.
Yeah. And Wyatt, like, I've talked about him before on the show. Like, he's a real fucking G. Like, he's one of the first he's the first comic to give me a full weekend at Caroline's, and I opened for him, and I got paid from the club, and then he paid me on top of that, and I'll never forget it. Like, and he dropped some wisdom on me too about some shit, and he kind of said he said something that kind of came to pass. I have to tell you off mic, but okay. But he's a real G, man. So I want to get into a little bit of your origin story. We may not cover all of it, but where did it start for you? Did it start for you in Long Island?
Yeah, man. So, like, you know, I grew up, born and raised in Long Island. You know, spent all of my formidable years out there. Grew up in, well, outside of Central Islip, which is a predominantly black neighborhood.
Okay.
But I was, like, right on the cusp in a town that they call Islandia. Mm-hmm. Which was, it used to be a part of Central Islip, but they broke it off because they were just like, hey, you know, there's some white people that live in this area. We don't want to have to send our kids to Central Islip School District because it's notoriously bad. So I was right between Ronkonkoma and Central Islip. I'm literally on the border, to the point where behind my house, the house across the street, behind there is a highway. And on the other side of the highway is Ronkonkoma. And also on the other side of the highway, like, apparently, like, rappers Eric Sermon lived in a development right over there. Like, Mariah Carey came by, was shooting videos over there and shit like that.
Wow.
We were literally on the border of everything. But, I know we may have talked about it at some point, because I said it a bunch of time on my podcast, but, like, you know, my dad, you know, was basically a street dude. You know, he grew up in North Carolina in 1937.
What part? You know, what part of North Carolina?
Durham.
Okay. That's where my parents are from. My family, really. Like, yeah.
There you go, yeah. A lot of my family were down there probably until recent, in the last few years. A lot of them kind of moved on.
So what did he do? Like, what was his job? What did your parents do?
Well... Again, my dad was a street dude, so okay. Like, he came up in, like...
And when you say streets, for the two white people that listen,
so So what do you mean? I'm saying, so my dad worked for Bumpy Johnson back in the day.
Oh shit. Oh, okay. All right.
Oh yeah, yeah. When I say street dude, he was a nigga on the streets.
Okay.
Yeah, he ran like number, well, he didn't run a number of spots. He like worked in a number of spots. He had like illegal clubs in Brooklyn, things like that. But on top of that, like, you know, he was kind of a handyman, like he was an electrician. He worked on the New York City subways and things like that, which he then later on rolled into. He was a landlord at a house where he could have built the house. He's like a general contractor.
Okay.
Think of it that way. But like unofficial.
Sure.
My mom, 12 years younger. You know, she grew up in like Brooklyn, Queens area, just moving around.
Wait, let me just pause there. Good for your dad. Yeah. 12 years younger. Good for your dad. Yeah. Good on your dad.
Hey, and for mom, she married a sugar daddy. So yeah. There you go.
Yeah. Good for them both. But yeah. Hey, like, yeah.
It's the come up.
Yeah.
So my mom worked in she did a bunch of things, but she ended up working for the United States Postal Service.
Okay.
Now she's like a union rep for them. To this very day, hopefully she's going to finally retire soon.
Yeah.
But and then they met. You know, my dad was living in Harlem, and you know, my mom, you know, in Brooklyn. I think in Brooklyn at the time, and then they met. Then at some point, came out to the island, and you know, that's where I was raised. You know, with So, I mean, this is a nigga story.
Hey, man, that's what we, shit, we niggas. So, I mean, what are we going to do, you know? Every experience I've had in Long Island has been pretty pleasant. Now, the first time, I wish that I could remember, when I first moved here, it seemed like I was taking it to get there from Jersey. It just seemed like an odyssey. It just seemed like a long ass drive. But that, I think when you don't know where you are in relation to where you're going.
And it depends what time it is, because that traffic is horrible.
Yeah. The first time, I wish I could remember where in Long Island it was, because it was a black woman that worked in HR at my company. She had a cookout for her daughter who was graduating. And she had all the new employees, like the young black people, come to her house. And it was like predominantly black. It was nice. It was nice. And then other than that, really, all the other things have been shows. And they were kind of like firehouse shows. Like one was, I can remember, was in Seaford, Long Island.
I've been there.
And it was just like mainly all white. It wasn't any racism or anything, but it just kind of reminded me more. I would say it reminded me a little more of home, of like my Maryland, DC area than where I live now. Even though I would say Hackensack, it's a city, but it's still the suburbs and stuff.
Yeah, but I mean, but you also have a lot of diversity there, because you know, there's a good there's a look at the Middle Eastern population in Hackensack. Obviously, a big black and Hispanic population as well.
Yeah. It just seemed like Long Island was a little more suburban.
It's far more suburban, but it's also Long Island, like in anywhere in the country.
Yeah.
If, you know, there are places you'll go and you'll find nothing. It's like this is a pocket where black people are.
Right.
Like, Central Islip is mostly a black neighborhood.
Okay.
Then neighboring it is Brentwood, which is mostly Hispanic.
Okay.
You know, so and then Bayshore is, again, mostly Hispanic. And then there's like some white people with boats, you know. So like it really changes, and it changes quickly, because like, you know, you could be some places like, oh, this is beautiful, and the next thing you know, it's just like, oh shit, I gotta get out of here.
Yeah. Yeah.
Which was crazy growing up, because like, you know, having family in the city and stuff like that, they would come out and they like, oh, I'm from you know, the Bronx, I'm from, you know, Brooklyn, and yada yada yada. This is like, yeah, I understand that, but don't mess around here, because that's not gonna help you.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Growing up out there, it was weird, because like I went, like, even though I lived in a black neighborhood, my parents sent me to private schools, because my dad, at, you know, he got a job as like the head custodian at one of the schools, a local school. So he realized the school district is not good here. So he refused to send us there. So he sent us to private school. Okay. So then
I had brothers and sisters. How many brothers and sisters?
Yeah. Oh, yeah. Oh, that's why I didn't get into that. So my mom has two children from previous marriages.
Okay.
And then my older brother and I. Gotcha. My dad has three children from previous marriages. Now, mind you, one of them, I only found out about at my dad's funeral. Oh. And she's 30 years older than me.
That old chestnut.
Yeah, that old chestnut. Still haven't met her. I only found out about her.
Damn.
So, yes. So it was just like a weird upbringing to like go to basically, for the most part, from a black neighborhood to a school where I'm kind of the only black family in the school.
Catholic school?
Yeah, so Catholic school, so we're the only black family in there, but then I go back home and nobody knows me because I don't go to the local school, so we were kind of, almost in a way, kind of felt like outcasts.
Yeah.
Because we didn't have a home in either place. We weren't ingrained in either community.
And did you have a lot of kids at in your neighborhood, kids your age?
Yeah, yeah. There's a good number of kids in the neighborhood, and like again, because we lived on a cusp, our neighborhood was a little bit more mixed.
Okay,
but but I would say it was probably 60-40 white.
I envy that because like I didn't have kids in my neighborhood. The only it was a next door neighbor. They moved away when I was about maybe anywhere between 5 and 7. So he moved away, and then there was that was it. There was a girl that she was a couple years older than me, but she was an ice skater, so I never hung out with her. It just wasn't that area. So when I would go over to my cousin's house in another town, like Temple Hills, Maryland, that was like there were more kids there. So I would be, I had kids, like other kids my age around there and also like my cousins. So I feel like I just missed out on that. It's like, oh, Jackie was my neighbor. Couldn't just say, hey, let's go ride bikes. Hey, come over to my house. Let's play video game. Ain't none of that shit.
Yeah.
Yeah.
See, but then let's throw a wrench into all that because my parents also adopted and fostered kids. So I also lived in an adopted home with my biological parents.
What was that like?
Dude, crazy.
Did you feel like you weren't getting enough attention, or?
Oh, for sure. That's why I'm the attention whore that I am.
And
today.
That's why you're an artist.
Exactly. I mean, because like you know, between the time of I was 3 to about like 13 when that last kid left, you know, about like 16 kids went through my house.
Jesus.
And my parents adopted 3 of them. Their parents adopted 3 of them, but for me. That's, you know, people's just like, oh, I can get along with anybody because I've dealt with everybody. But, you know, we were taking in black kids. We're taking in black kids from the city in the 80s. So, you know, I live with a crack baby. Mm. You know what I'm saying? I live with kids with like really, really difficult upbringings. So it's like for me, like I understand all of that stuff. And like so, understanding that kind of stuff and living in Long Island is very rare because like, you know. Most people, they're just so disconnected from everything in the city. So it's like, you know, when people start telling me about, you know, like, oh, it's like when you're growing up, it's like, yeah, I get it. Like, no, you don't. You grew up in Long Island. It's like, nah, man, I probably know more about it than you do.
That's interesting because, you know, like, because technically from where you grew up, what kind of a drive is that? An hour, hour and a half? Or
maybe 45 minutes to an hour.
Yeah, like, it's so, like... Because you're in such a major metropolitan area, a lot of that stuff spills into the suburbs anyway, and then you get a little bit of everything in a place like Long Island anyway. That, I mean, that's what I would imagine just being
there,
you know?
Technically, actually, no.
No? It's still blocked off?
Long Island's a little different because like a lot of people who live in Long Island, they never leave Long Island. They're afraid of the city. They won't go. They don't want to experience new people. And that's one of the main reasons why I had to get out because like it's such a closed-minded space that like it became like I outgrew it, and I outgrew it quickly because, and it's also, you know, being, you know, as a kid, I got such, you know, I was diversified at such a young age, and I, you know, my eyes are open. I couldn't just stay in that one place.
Yeah. Okay. Yeah. That's really interesting because I seem to have found that here too. Just even when you think of like stand up and comedy, like I would do, like Gordon Baker Bone used to have a room in Kenilworth, New Jersey, fucking fun room, 10th Street Live, I believe. Yeah. And you'd meet all these comics and a lot of them were really funny. It's like, oh, how often do you go into the city? I never go, man. I'm scared. You're scared. Yeah. It's like, dude, you're 24. What the fuck are you doing? Like you want to get good at this shit, right? They're scared to go into the city. Like I was talking at the Drunk Black History show in February, I'm talking to a comic, really nice guy. Like I've seen him a few times, we're friends on Facebook. And he's like, yeah, man, driving into the city. I'm like, what? Are you kidding me, dude? Dude, you're a man.
Yeah.
you could drive it. Cause I'll say this till the day that I die. Adrian Appalucci, funny, really funny comic. On Sarah's podcast partner, I remember one time I would go into the city. I had some of those fears, like I just didn't know where I was going because I was new to the city. I would like drive to Hoboken and take the path over and go into the city and do spots or go to shows and stuff like that. And one time I was telling Adrian about something. It was after a show. We were sitting somewhere, and she said, Chris, you can drive into the city. Stop being a pussy. Just drive into the city. You'll find parking. Don't worry about it. Yeah. And ever since then, I think she added at least 5 years onto my life with that conversation. It's not hard. I said, look, I told that comic, I was like, look, dude, if I can do it, you can do it. You'll be fine. It's not hard.
It's like, especially if you're white.
Yeah. Well, this was a black guy, but yeah, but it's both. It's like a little bit of both.
You know what? But I think it goes back to, you know, fear of the unknown, man.
Yeah.
Fear of the unknown.
Very true.
You know, and there's things like people, we stick around what we know, and something has to hit you in the head to make you say, hey, you know what? There's something else out there for me, and I got to risk it.
Yeah. That's so interesting, man. Like, cause I always looked at my hometown area as a place that made me who I am, and for the good and the bad, but mostly for the good. But there's a lot of people you see look on Facebook and they're still in Maryland, and I'm like, and they have good lives. Financially, mm-hmm. they're doing way better than me, and they have families and shit. And it's like, good for them. I never grew up as I gotta get the fuck out of here. It was just natural progression, you know, like,
yeah,
it was never like, oh, I gotta get the fuck out of here. But it's like, I want the stuff that I want isn't here, so I just have to move. And then I had the support from my parents, but
what was it for you that really made you say, all right, you know, I gotta go? Like, what would because I feel like we all have that like defining moment. There's like something that happens, or there was a place that you were, a feeling that you felt that made you decide. It's like, yeah, this is it.
I would say I was a junior in college and I was going to Mount St. Mary's, which is now a university. And it's in Emmitsburg, Maryland, which is like an hour and a half from where I grew up in PG County. It's not that far. So you kind of have your freedom of being like, yeah, I'm a grown up, and then I can still get my mom to do my laundry. I can still drive home and, you know, all that shit. And you still have this, it's like, you still have like that safety net.
Yeah.
And so I started to just say, like, I really want to commit to acting. Like, I was doing well doing theater and stuff in college, and I wanted to take it to the next level. I wanted to, like, either, you know, possibly moved to New York. And I remember talking to, and I just looked at a lot of the actors that I liked, whether they were super famous or just actors that were working on TV shows. Like, I look at this guy, you probably know who he is. You're an actor, Russell Hornsby.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. Yeah.
Like I like Russell Hornsby, Courtney B. Vance, Angela Bassett, like like they had went to school. And I started reading August Wilson when I was in college, too. And that's like, I don't know if you experienced this coming up where it's like a lot of times you'll do plays and it'll just be it was always colorblind casting. If you were just black, but you were playing a white dude. And then, you know, like I was in Bye Bye Birdie. I was like the lead in Bye Bye Birdie, the Albert or whatever, the guy that was Conrad Birdie's manager. You know, I would do all these, the Misanthrope, Moliere, Importance of Being Earned. That was white people shit, really, you know. Yeah. I went to a predominantly black Catholic school. And so it was just a thing. Like, we were just doing all these plays. But it wasn't until, like, my sophomore year, like, I discovered August Wilson. And I was like, oh, these guys sound like my uncle. This guy sounds like my dad. This sounds like the guy at the barbershop. Holy shit. Wow. And I just had this awakening, and I started looking at the people that played those parts, and they were people that like that may have originated those roles, like Charles Dutton. And I was like, fuck. And like, they got their start in theater, like a lot of them. And then I started looking like, oh, this guy went to grad school. This guy went to Yale. This guy went to Delaware, like Steve Harris and shit, like from The Practice. And I was like, fuck. And I remember my theater director, he said, oh, you should go to Chicago. And I went to Northwestern, and blah, blah, blah. It's a great place for theater. And I did these auditions that were called the ERTAs. I think it's called like Unified Residential Theater Association, where it's like this. It's almost like, I don't know if it's like Montreal to a certain degree. What would be that equivalent? It was a clearinghouse audition where you pay them $85 and you go to this regional location. Mine was in New York, and you get judged by these theater professors and stuff. And then schools will try to get at you. Like, schools will try to recruit you.
Gotcha.
And so I went to that. My parents took me up there and up here, and I did the audition. And then they had like a first round that was like a screening thing, which is bullshit. They should have just let everybody that wanted to go. And like, I know, right? It was some bullshit. So I didn't get past the first round for some fucking reason. Can you fucking believe that, bro?
And remember Michael Jordan didn't make that first team.
I know.
You know.
And so they had this thing called like, okay, if you didn't make it past the first round, there was like this audition space in a coffee house, and you could do like a 1 minute monologue. So I went to that. I did 1 minute, and Roosevelt University was the only school that gave me an offer. Or like that said, oh, we're interested in you. And I sat in the hotel room with other people. It wasn't a Me Too moment. It was two of the professors, and they were like, yeah, we like you and stuff. You know, we want to just here's a packet, and you know, we'll set something up. And did the application process. My dad and I flew out there, and we were like, oh, this is cool. First time on a plane. That's one thing. Like, your art taking you places you've never been.
Yeah,
and that was huge. And I had an audition at Yale, and that didn't work. But in hindsight, I would have. You can tell I'm giving you the long answer. But in hindsight, I would have auditioned for more schools, along with that ERTA audition. But so I didn't get into Yale. And Roosevelt said, "Hey, you know, we liked you. We want you to come in, and here's some scholarship money for blah blah blah." And then the rest was history. But I would definitely say that, looking at a lot of the black actors that I really admired coming up, I saw that they had some type of formal training. And I said, go ahead.
The one thing that I really, is like, you had, like, your mom and your dad, you know, they were very supportive and they came with you.
Yeah.
And I think, you know, for anybody, whether you're an artist or not, like, how important that is. You know, to a kid, that somebody is like, yo, I got your back in this, whether, yeah, you know, they think it's a dumb idea or not. Because like,
yeah.
And because even like, you know, I look at like my parents, like my mom has never seen me perform.
Really?
To this day has not. Well, I mean, well, she's, you know, things I've done on television. Yes.
Why?
But like,
did you ever ask her why?
She's just, but also like, I don't know whether it's by design or not. Like as a kid, like I'd have basketball games, stuff like that. And like, because it worked out in the schedule that like I would, you know, no one like really came to my games. Damn. So like I had this thing where I'm just like, I'm in this alone. But that's how I've always pushed ahead in life. Yeah. And like, and I look back and I'm just like, yo, if I had this a little bit more of a team behind me, like, and now realizing as an adult, it's like how big that would have been, you know, for my career, or just for my psyche. I mean, like my dad, he came to one show, and that was like towards, you know, before he really got sick. And like, he came, like, I didn't know he was going to come. All of a sudden, I just heard him laughing. I just heard his laugh. Wow. A very distinct laugh out in the audience, and that show meant the world to me.
I bet.
You know, Jesus. Even though it, you know, he came to the UCB for the dirtiest sketch in New York.
But he had a good time. What did he say to you after?
His main thing is like, boy, you got some shit with you. You got some shit with you, boy. It was good. It was good.
Oh man, that's dope.
Yeah, but like, you know, I don't think that people realize, like, even like your, you know, friends and family, when you put, when you give just even a little bit, you know, to an artist and say, hey, like, we got you, you know, we're here for you, yeah. We're rooting for you. That's, you know, that's all we need.
In a lot of ways, I think you, it's a different way to the mountaintop, and it's just like, but that definitely helped. It helped a lot. And it was something that, and then at the same time, there's pressure with that too. Like, I mean, just the first real SAG part, like my listeners know this, is I cried in the car and I called my parents. I just broke down, and that's the scene. And I eventually got cut, but I booked it. You know what I mean? Like, it was just like, that was like validation that, just like, yeah,
that you were doing something right.
Yeah, that it paid off. I mean, so talk a little bit about, let's not make this about me. We talked like in February, we actually talked that Drunk Black History. It's like, yeah, you got to do my podcast. And what sparked me even wanting to get you on, wanted to, you know, really lock this down, was just you talked about being a black artist in the UCB
before it was UCB.
Yeah, like just like it's to talk a little bit about that, like talk about where you were in your life when before you got in with them.
So I guess I'll just say, like, when I was a kid, I knew that like I wanted to, there were two things I liked. I like Eddie Murphy, and I liked the Ninja Turtles and Bruce Lee. So I said, I want to be either a professional fighter or I want to stand on the stage and tell jokes. Cause you know, my siblings were much older than me. So like I was watching shit as a kid I shouldn't have been seeing. So
yeah.
So like, you know, like those were, so like when I was a kid and you'd been a class clown and all that kind of stuff, you know, I was always in trouble. But like as I grew older, I kind of strayed away from comedy because every time I did it, I was always being pounded down saying, no, 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 stop. You're, what are you doing?
Is that by like your peers or just like them not getting it?
It's, you know, school, you know, so my teachers. And then it's also like, you know, sometimes, you know, like, you know, my friends' girlfriends, like none of them liked me. he's just wild, you know, he's too sarcastic, he's this, it's just like, so like all those outside forces made me feel like I was doing something wrong.
But isn't that maybe you just weren't doing it at the right time? But like maybe you're in algebra but you're cracking jokes.
Well, no, 100%, 100%. But it's just like when you hear when you hear so many no's and then so many
yeah, hearing it either
know,
way,
visceral ways. It's only yeah. It's like maybe I should chill out. So like, but when I went to college, you know, I went to college, business administration, marketing, stuff like that.
Where'd you go to college?
Iona College in Westchester.
Oh yeah, that's Rochelle. Okay.
So, my sophomore year for the summer, I went to Marine Corps Officer Candidate School.
Okay.
And so, because I thought at one point, I was like, maybe I'm going to go into the Marines. All right. And when I was down there, like, that's where that was the click. That's where it happened for me. Because, like, they would put us in, like, positions of leadership. And, like, my job at one point was, like, 2 weeks. I was the company gunnery sergeant. So I'd have to give these speeches in front of in front of, like, 300 people on, a daily basis. And, like, I was in charge of, doing this and doing that. And during my time there, there were some things that were going down at boot camp and whatnot that I didn't like. And I stood up and I, kind of, and I spoke out about things and like kind of read motherfuckers their rights. But then, like, afterwards, like, people come like, yo, man, I really felt you were saying this, like, and they really encouraging. But I realized, oh shit, I have power in my voice as opposed to, everyone telling me I'm doing wrong. It's like there, I have something. And then when I was sitting in a bunk at night, and I'm listening to all these war stories and all this craziness and things like that. That's when I realized it's just like I only have one life. I want to make sure I don't waste it. And like the two things I wanted to do was I wanted to do comedy. I wanted to fight and all that. And then and so once I left boot camp, I said, you know what? I'm gonna go after my dreams.
How old
So
were you?
I was 20, 21.
Okay.
Yeah, so that's what really started it. From there, well, I hosted a fashion show at my school, and then like I started doing like little things, but at the same time I was I was fighting. I was doing like MMA
Really?
for a bit. Yeah, I did martial arts since I was like 11 years
I
old.
feel like you mentioned that before.
Yeah, so
Yeah, I
like
feel, yeah, okay. All right.
so you know so
That's a
like I
whole
was
nother podcast.
yeah, I mean, that's a whole different thing. But like all of that, what was going on is like I just wanted to pursue the things that made me happy, that my heart yearned for. And once I graduated and I was trying to get to UFC, I was and working out and just like absorbing so and well, I couldn't find a job because I came out in 2007, so like yeah, the job market was shit.
Oh,
And
undergrad, that's when you graduated?
yeah.
Okay.
So like I was trying to find a job, and then all of a sudden, 2008 hit, and it got even worse. So I was kind of just like, I'm gonna go on Craigslist. I'm just gonna find gigs to do, so just so I can pay my car payment, or whatever I got to pay,
Were
you
you living
know.
in the city or were you in Long Island?
I was living in Long Island at the time because I didn't have no money to move out.
Yeah.
So from there. One of my friends was doing stuff at the UCB. He's like, and he'd been telling me for maybe about 2 years, like, you need to come down, you need to come down, take classes. I'm like, man, I need a job. I'm trying to get on Ultimate Fighter and all this stuff like that. And then I finally, I booked a TV, I booked a pilot for a game show with one of the dudes from Impractical Joker, James Murr.
Okay.
And also Keegan-Michael Key.
Wow. So
And
what was that like? Was it, I mean, like, did you just happen upon this audition? What were you doing to put you in the position to even audition for something like
dude,
that?
it all came from like the Craig, it came from those random Craigslist posts.
Oh, wow.
And
Okay.
then basically what happened, I went in for an audition for something, and the casting director thought I was ridiculous, and then just kept calling me back for like little things. She's like, I got this guy. And then that's when I met James Murr, and then he was a casting director at the time.
Okay.
And then we ended up doing that show. It was actually Keegan-Michael Key, and Bert Kreischer was the host.
Oh, okay. I feel like
So
I listen to him. I listen to him and Burr, and I listen to him sometimes too. Like I
yeah.
think I remember that shit.
he's an interesting dude. He's an interesting dude, but like hanging out with him and talking to him, I can see why he, because he's just, he's a beacon of energy.
Oh yeah, I bet. Yeah.
Beacon of energy. But like, I was talking to Keegan-Michael Key after the this whole thing shot. He's just like, so, so what do you do? Like, you know, you're an actor. And I'm like, nah, man, I'm kind of a fighter. And I'm, you know, just, you know, trying to, you know, this, they're going to pay me $350. So you know, here I am. He's just like, man, like, what are you doing? Take classes. He's like, you're funny. He's like, you're funny. Like, you brought energy. Like you're, like, you're really funny. You're a comic. You need to, don't waste this.
Really?
So.
Wow. You know, I never heard this story.
Yeah. Not a lot of people did. I really don't talk about it a lot.
That's you, because he was like on his way. Like maybe
he was on Mad. He
already just Mad TV.
Mad TV. Yeah, he just finished Mad TV.
Wow.
I think, or maybe it was he may have been on his last season of Mad TV at that time.
And he could tell because he used to, I feel like he used to teach. I feel like
used to what?
I feel like he used to teach like acting and so, like. Improv and stuff. I feel like
he also wrote plays. He's a playwright.
Yeah,
he wrote plays in Chicago and things like that.
Yeah,
which is funny. Like he told me it's amazing. Like there was a character that I used to love. It was Eugene Stubbs.
Okay,
and he's like, you know, this is like, you know, I'm gonna take it right here to a whole nother level.
Yeah,
like,
yeah.
That character was on Mad TV because he was just like ambush like stars. You know, like, you know, they're doing an interview and then he just show up and he just start interviewing them instead.
Yeah.
Because he was like a water delivery guy. And he just come and sit down and just start saying craziness. But like, he was telling me where that character came from. Mm-hmm. And like, as I'm listening to him talk about that, like, it's like, I'm start picking away at his process on how he does things.
Yeah.
And like, you know, like the comic mind works. And I'm just like, this is so interesting to me. Mm-hmm. So then, like, I think it had to be like 2 weeks later, or maybe the next week, I went to UCB to go see a show. And that's when I saw the Stepfathers, is Chris Gethard, Bobby Moynihan, Zach Woods.
Wow.
I can't remember who else
Holy
was on
shit.
That. There was Will Hines. Oh, shit. And it, like, there's two guys that you would know from television.
If you saw them, yeah. I know the first three you mentioned, shit.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So, and like, I watched that show and I was just like, yo, I got to do this. So I stalked out Bobby Moynihan's class because I thought he was the funniest dude that night. And I got into Bobby Moynihan's class and like, that's where it started.
So this was 08.
Yeah.
Shit. Level one in 08. That's when I did it. Like, that's what. Wait, did I do 08? I feel like I did. Yeah.
So we probably definitely crossed paths at some. Well, I mean, you know, we definitely probably may have saw each other at least.
And I was going to that. What? Because the training center was like in like the fashion
around
district.
The corner on like 30th or something like that.
Yeah. Is that still considered fashion district?
Yeah.
Okay.
Well, yeah. Fashion District, Koreatown, like all in, it's kind of in that little bubble over there.
That's crazy. Yeah.
Yeah, so. It's like 316, like 30th Avenue or some shit like that. 316A.
And what was that experience like working with Bobby?
Well, first of all, Bobby was amazing.
Yeah.
He actually told me, he's just like, yo, you're doing something right. Continue, go on with this. Like he
wasn't bullshitting you either, was he?
No, like, dude, I saw him maybe like 2 years after my 101. He was on SNL. I just happened to run into him at the theater. He's like, I'm glad you're here. He's like, you know, I think you're really funny. And like, just little things he said in class. He's like, I think you're really funny. He's like, just keep going. I was like, and then crazy enough, I extra'd on Sisters with Amy Poehler and Tina Fey.
Oh yeah. He was in that movie,
and like he was in the film. Like, you know, I didn't want to bother him.
Yeah.
But like, you know, it was at lunch. He's like, hey man, I know you from somewhere. I'm like, I was actually in your 101 class. He's like, oh, you're like, that was like one of his last 101s. It's like, I remember. He was like, man, he's like, you're really funny. It's like, I'm glad that you're still doing it.
That's
like,
dope. Yeah.
Yeah. He's like, he's my Yoda.
Okay. That's what's
he's
up.
He's my Yoda. But like, because at first, like, I don't know how I felt about it. I mean, I was the only black kid there. there's only black a dude there.
Mm-hmm.
And because, you know, at the time I was fighting and all this kind of stuff like that, I was, you know, pretty well built. So it felt like everybody else was kind of intimidated of me. Mm. So like I didn't feel like I was part of the community.
Cause you had to, didn't you have to practice with them too, for at least for your graduation class? Cause I just remember that, like, we all, one time we got together and did. Yeah.
Well, and then also on top of that, like, I didn't live in the city. So like I was, you know, like, I know we talked about this on a call.
You can
like,
talk about it if you want. Talk about it.
Well, you know, I used to, I would drive out, you know, well, my deal, like, I was working at like a Verizon or at the time. No, I think I was working at, I was working at the mall. That's the only job I could freaking get at that time.
In Long Island.
I was working at the mall. And then I would go training and whatnot, you know, doing my fighting shit. And then I would drive into the city to go to sketch classes or, you know, to do a show or see a show, whatever I had to do.
Yeah.
And then I would, I would sleep in my car.
Yeah.
Then wake up, because if I had an audition the next day, go to the gym so I can shower up and get a good workout in, and then go do my audition, then drive back out to Long Island and make sure I was at work. So like, that was my hustle. I was hustling so hard. I didn't have time to do all the extracurriculars with everybody else.
Mm-hmm.
And I remember I said that at a UCB diversity meetup.
Oh,
and people
shit.
Looked at me like I was fucking crazy.
Why? Why do they look at you like you were crazy?
I don't know. Like, but everyone looks like, oh shit. But I guess in their minds it's like, oh shit, this guy really wants it. But that, you know.
And then you can do, how old were you? 23, 24?
Yeah, about 23, 24.
That hustle and that grind, I mean, you can do that when you're young, and it's almost like you're supposed to do it. But I did that shit too. But by the time I got there in 2008, I was like 28, and I realized that I was like, I think I have an MFA, and this is fucking dope. But I couldn't afford to take all those classes.
Yeah.
But I did enjoy it. But what I'm not understanding is why those people in the diversity group didn't know. They looked at you like you were crazy, like they didn't know, like you were speaking another language.
Well, you know what? That's the thing. I think, well, also the UCB at that point, that was, you know, a little later in the diversity, when the diversity group started to come out.
Okay.
So like, you know, that was, you know, you had all these kids that start coming in from NYU and things like that. So they were all like city kids, but they were like come from like school, and then they, you know, their parents paid for class at UCB as their extra. It was like the extracurricular activity.
Is that around? Would you call that around the time of the boom, where like things started to really blow up? Like, I guess after Moynihan booked it, then everybody's like, "Well, I'm gonna do it too." And Donald Glover.
That basically, I came in right before the boom.
Okay.
And then when the bubble so really started filling for UCB, that's when like really things started to change. And like, that's when I kind of started not liking it anymore.
Mm.
Because that community aspect, once I got into the community and people kind of knew me, like, it was great. But then like, it became, you know, the politics and all this other stuff, is just like, it kind of disheartened me. And I didn't want to be a part of it anymore, because it wasn't about, you know, going out there and doing good work and being funny. It was, you know, it was politicking, and I don't have time for politicking. I left the military because of that shit.
Can you be, I want you to be more specific about the politics. Two, did you feel like people, maybe I'll come back to that, but just what were some of the politics?
So I ended up making the mod team, and
I want to know about the politics, but first I want to know, what was it like? Like, was it like you after you get past level four, then you're able to get put on the team?
Well, not necessarily, because you could have got put on a team whenever you got put on a team.
Oh, really?
You know, like you audition for it just like you'd audition anything else. But, you know, it's like when you felt like you were ready, you wanted to go for it, you could go for it. And I auditioned the first time I auditioned, you know, I went in with, you know, with some characters and whatnot. It's like auditioning for SNL.
Okay.
You know, I really feel like I didn't have it. Actually, to tell you the truth, I know, I can tell you exactly why I didn't, because like I wasn't prepared. I wasn't prepared for that first audition because I was running on a little sleep and all that kind of stuff. So it was like outside factors, and my mind wasn't right to go in there and do the things I had to do.
Mm.
So my preparation wasn't there. Next year I came back. I said, I'm going to get this shit. And I did. So you had 3 minutes, and in 3 minutes, I probably dropped down about like maybe like 15 different impersonations, impersonations, characters, things like that. Like, and like some of them were really quick. The way I structured it was, I'm gonna structure it like if somebody's sitting there changing the channel on their television.
Yeah.
So it's like you change the channel. It's like it's a commercial for you know, hey y'all, I'm LL Cool J. This is for Burt's Beeswax. I'm just licking my lips the entire time. Now you change something else. So like that's how I structured my thing. And yeah. It's like I knew the moment I stepped in there, like my energy was right, and I was like, I'm gonna burn this motherfucker down. And what, I did.
Was it in Chelsea? On. Was it in Chelsea or was it in the training center?
No, it was in the training center.
What's that? Is it just like a rack of people in there watching you, or what is it like? Like,
yeah, so like it was basically like artistic director, a bunch of like, you know, people who are like on the right, you know, who are writers and things like that. Basically, it's just a table of about like 8 people just sitting there watching you.
And there's no crowd. It's just the 8 people that are making the decision.
Yeah.
Fuck. Yeah, that's. That's and in that I fucking I love that room, dude. I love that room.
It's, you know, but see, my thing is like I love the room when the room is right.
Oh yeah, you know yeah. Oh because, yeah.
And it doesn't necessarily anything have to do with my performance, but you know what I'm talking about, like that energy.
Yes.
That energy, like where they're ready. They're ready to hear something,
mm-hmm.
or you know, there's at least a little bit of excitement, or sometimes it's just like I'm gonna bring some shit that they haven't seen all day,
mm-hmm.
and you know you're about to walk into and surprise them with some shit, but there's also that time where you step into that room and this is like you get hit with a wave of negativity that just kills, that sucks all the energy out of the room and out of your performance.
Well, I don't want to gloss over the positive thing that you just said. I'm so upset that I never really, I did a College Humor Live there once, and I think it's on YouTube somewhere. That was fucking, I would go in there, I would go to Whiplash and just like love being in that room, just wanting to perform there. But enough about me. So this experience, so you go in there and you got 3 minutes. I'm wondering how many other black people were auditioning.
Well, I'll just tell you this. I could, on the Maud night, it was me, Sashir, it was Sean Dotson, it was Carl Foreman, it was Natasha Rothwell.
Fuck.
I think Phil Jackson was a what you call it? I think he was a writer on a team later on.
Okay,
I think he was on the writing side.
So you knew all of them. So you knew them, and you guys were auditioning at the same time.
Well, to tell you the truth, I met Sashir, and we both got on the same team.
Wow.
So me, Sashir, it was my team was actually stacked. Okay. I fell into a great situation. It was me, Sashir, Steve. Why am I forgetting his name? I love this dude. I just go by Steve. I don't know why I'm forgetting his name. Steve, John Milheiser. We had Sarah came in. Michael Hartney, who was the artistic director at UCB. Stephanie Benson, David, I can't remember his last name.
So how big is this team? Some of them were writers. Sarah was a writer.
Writers, actors. I think it was about 8 of us.
Okay. Damn, that is because that's your fucking cast. Like, that's your team. Yeah. Like, that's, I can imagine. That's fucking awesome. So, like, was that like a placement? Was that like, okay, Justin's going to with Shashir and this people, they can write for, okay, all right.
And you know what? And I will say, like, you know, maybe I'm biased, but I think we had the hottest team, on, you know, in the UCB at that point.
Well, it sounds like it.
Our shows were magnificent messes. Oh, Amber Nielsen. Nielsen was on our team as well.
Yeah, Amber Nielsen. I know her. Yeah. She's in LA now.
Yeah. The dude, like, we, like, I remember I got called in for, you know, to redo some of that Fox or something like that. And the woman's like, yo, I was at your show. Like, I was at your show for whatever show. And I know it was a fucking solid one. And she was just like, your whole vibe, your entire team's vibe is just something just next level. And she was just like, and I loved this. And she's throwing out particular sketches and particular lines that I put. It was just a melding of minds. It was perfect.
Damn.
And that's why. And I love that. But at the same time, we also had, you know, it was hard. Because, like, I would pitch things to writers, and maybe, you know, because I'm also, it was my first time, you know, doing pitches and things like that, that, like, I would put things out there, but I felt like it wasn't well received, or, like, they didn't understand it, because, like, they would write it, and then it would turn into something else. And I'm just like, this is not the idea.
So it was another black writer on that staff. No. So
Sashir was a writer-actor.
Okay,
but she really wrote her own things.
Uh huh.
So she didn't really like, we had some sketches which were just like, you know, I would say that one of the best sketches I was in that was my idea was, so what Steven Seagal had, you know, Steven Seagal Lawman.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, so, like, which is ridiculous, Steven Seagal fighting crime in Louisiana. Yeah. But, like, at the same time, Shaq had gotten deputized in Miami. So I was like, yo, what if we did a show called Shaq Undercover? Which is funny because Shaq can't go undercover because Shaq is fucking huge.
Yeah.
So the sketch was me standing on a chair with oversized clothing as Shaq and, like, everyone kind of acting around me. And me and everybody's just like, no, this is my partner. It's like, that's Shaquille O'Neal. It's like, you're right, Shaq, and I'm undercover. You know, just blowing my cover because I'm a fucking idiot.
You're right, I'm Shaq. I'm undercover.
So and like that whole thing, you know, it was great, but like it was one of the things that for some reason it was never taped. And like we have tons of you know, sketches online, stuff like that, and that wasn't taped. And it's like, yeah, this is my sign of achievement. Like, this is the one that you guys got right, and we didn't get this one.
That's interesting, but what would, because it seemed to me you were still kind of green and doing all this doing big shit. What was your entire tenure at UCB? How long was that? Like in years? How long was that?
Well, I would say I was on Maud Night for 2 years.
So I mean, like even when you started, because you were like 22.
Oh, yeah.
21, 22 when you started.
I was 24. I was 24 when I started UCB, 2008.
Okay.
So, like, I started in 2008, and then, like, when I would say it was, like, maybe 5 years, 5 years ago I left. I'm 36 now. So it was 5 years that I did most of my training and then performing at UCB.
See, that's pretty remarkable, dude, because I'm looking at somebody like Sashir and Natasha Rothwell. As great as they are, I feel like they've been doing it a little longer and before you started. Yeah. Like, yeah. That's like, I think they had a little more training and seasoning. But yes, that's pretty good for a black dude that to just come like, I'm going to start this. I'm 24. I'm starting this shit. That's remarkable, dude. I didn't even know that. Like, I just knew you were a funny guy and just a cool dude, but I didn't know that shit.
Yeah,
that's why, man, I was like, fuck, that's huge.
Well, I mean, like, and, you know, 2000. Yeah, too. Like all that time I started doing sketch, UCB, improv, stand up, everything all at once. And was still managing a fight career at the time, but I think like 2009 is when I stopped fighting because I got I dislocated my elbow, so I was going to be out for a bit, and I didn't have no insurance, so I just had to let it heal.
Fuck.
And then And it's funny because I was going to try out for a UC UCB for the UFC Ultimate Fighter 6, and it just, you know, obviously it happened like literally the week before my tryout, so I was like, well, you know, like I couldn't lift my arm for a bit, and like I was really fucked. I was just like, I can't, so I'm just gonna heal and I'll come back another time. And then at that point, there's like UCBs, just things just started clapping. So I'm just like, you know what? I'm going to go with comedy.
That's dope.
I feel better when I'm doing this, because when I was writing, you know, you have to go into a certain mindset. And, you know, I don't technically like to be there all the time. And, yeah. You know, this and it's kind of a toxic kind of community that, you know.
Yeah. Oh, yeah. So like the political stuff is just like they weren't getting you. There wasn't like another black dude or a black person on the staff. It was like, hey, I know what you mean. You're talking about this. You're talking about X.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, and all those Sashir, you know, was on the team, and, you know, nothing negative. Like I thought Sashir is great, but it's like also like Sashir's been there for so long.
Right. Right. Right.
You know, they got her.
Yeah.
You know? And like for me, I didn't feel that. I didn't feel as welcome. And, you know, and like you said, you know, maybe I was still a little bit green and I was still, you know, coming up. But like, man, you know, because of UCB, I auditioned for Star Wars.
Holy shit.
Yeah, I auditioned for a role of Finn.
I think you mentioned that. I think you did mention that before. Yeah.
But also, you know, me walking into that audition, I knew I wasn't ready. But at the same time, it's like literally my dad just died before that. And also like I was not in the place, not in the place for it.
Yeah. Well, I mean, that's pretty dope, dude, because I didn't know that about you. I didn't really know that much about UCB. I think we might have met at some weird, I think I did one of Brandon's show. It was a show. Maybe it was you guys' show. It was, I forget.
Oh, the Grits shows.
The Grit shows, yeah. You guys were at this place, and they had these amazing nachos.
Choice Kitchen.
I think so. Yeah, it was like the nachos with the fixings already on, like on each chip. Yep. Oh my god, dude.
Yeah. They were killing it.
Yeah, dude. That's because I think what brought it up the last time I was did a show in the city. It was a Sunday night and I'm at Subculture. I see a lot of fucking black faces and I was like, wow. And they were killing.
Yeah.
And it's like, don't you guys want this shit? Y'all don't want more of this shit? Like to, and then the fact that they don't pay, it was just like, oh.
Yep. Yeah.
It just didn't.
I mean, that's just the way of the land, man.
Mm-hmm. It's one of those things, because on the stand-up side, you know, there was a thing where, you know, Kurt Metzger had a rant on Facebook when he used to do that about how they don't pay people for spots and all that. And like, you shouldn't go. And it's like, look, I have a day job. And this is a space for me to perform. I'm not performing there every week. Would it be nice if they paid? Yes. But I'm like, if I can work this shit out, and be ready by the time, if I could work this shit out in that room on Thursday at UCB East, when I got a gig on Saturday that's paying and I need to be funny, really, I'm gonna take that spot so I could be ready for Saturday.
You know, it's funny. I've actually never performed stand up at UCB.
Never.
Never. It's because like that's one of It's funny because like. You know, with you know having a you know a baby and you know everything else going on in life, you know, I took you know some time off because you know, I had to get my fucking life together.
Of course, yeah.
I was on like I said, you know, February I'm gonna start doing stand up again, and then I'm gonna write my one man show and I'm gonna put it up at UCB.
Mm.
And Mother now Nature like, said, like I can't do that. I can't do that. I literally cannot do that because UCB is not a thing anymore.
It's so weird, dude. Like it's
like coronavirus took like oh, this is gonna be the comeback tour. It's like the guys are like, nope, no, it's not. Shut up.
It was fascinating to me that when they talked about them going bankrupt or whatever is going on there, places are closing and stuff. It was fascinating to me to see all the interesting digs that people had, not only for people of color, but just in general. If it's either the thinly veiled racism, the rape, or not paying people, it's just it was fascinating to look at.
Yeah, are you seeing the whole thing with Keisha right now?
Keisha.
Hey, Keisha. Keisha Zolt. I cannot remember her last name. So basically, she was running the diversity and everything like that for a long time.
Okay.
And they feel like people just like trying to stick up for her. They're like, you know, they should pay you. They should pay her and, you know, take care of her.
Oh, wow.
Which is just true. Yeah. It's literally going on right now.
I did not know that. No, I'm not in that. I tried to date a girl that was a UCB performer. It didn't work out. But but yeah, it wasn't because of UCB, but I just like,
yeah,
I think I met her at a show or something. But yeah, dude, like that. That's an interesting thing, like, man. And so I don't. We're running up against your heart out. So talk about and plug Medium Popcorn. How did you meet Brandon, and how did you guys start it?
It's fun. I met Brandon at a college humor set in like 2009.
Okay.
Yeah. So like Brandon's like one of my first comedy friends. Other than like people I met at UCB.
Okay.
We were on a set in Staten Island all fucking day, improvising in character. We stayed in character all day. We never broke character. And, you know, from there, we started a sketch comedy group called Grits. We started doing stand up shows and whatnot. Yeah. Actually, you know, I would credit Brandon for really getting me to really spend, you know, spend more time in crafting, my stand up routine. Because, you know, I was doing so much acting and sketch stuff like that, like, you know, stand up, which it's funny because I love it more than anything. You know, it just, I was just worried about other stuff. But then, 5 years ago, almost 5 years come August, you know, we started doing Medium Popcorn, you know, viewing these movies new and old. You know, I'd probably say it started out with Brandon more of the straight man, and I'm just like the wild animal. And it switched to, you know, Brandon's a wild animal. I'm a wild animal, but Brandon's far more of a wild animal.
You're the straight man. Like, there's a clear delineation that you're the straight man. Like, you have to bring that in. And now he's got that soundboard.
Yeah, he's out of control with the soundboard.
Yeah, it's fun, man, and I love doing the show, and I love the fact that I always love the movie that we review, and you guys hate it. Well, Brightburn was a pretty straightforward did when I was on.
Yeah, we all like that one.
Yeah, you guys hated The Faculty. You guys, and I realize what it is. Like, one is I got a few years on you. Two, true. I like those dimension films kind of have like I have a sense of nostalgia for quite a few of those dimension films, like The Faculty, fucking, I don't know if Long Kiss Goodnight, I think, might have been New Line, but Reindeer Games was one of them, because I went out with hot girl to see that one.
A lot of those dimension films, like, yeah, I wasn't a huge, huge fan of them.
Yeah.
It's like, you know, I was fucking with New Line, I was fucking with Blade.
Oh, yeah, I mean, shit, Money Talks was New Line. I had a bunch of New Line joints, too. I think maybe I just look back on those with maybe rose colored glasses, because even when I'm not on the show and I'm listening, I'm like, God, y'all ain't like that. But then it is fun when y'all shit on stuff too. But
you know what? Yeah, I think of course it's always fun to shit on anything, but. You know, one of the things I think that, you know, we're going to try to do, especially, you know, under everything going on, is we want to highlight some, like, you know, black artists, you know, a little bit more. And, you know, because, you know, like we were talking on the phone the other day, you know, Kelvin Harrison Jr., that kid's fucking.
I love that guy.
Next level.
You got it. I think he kind of stole that. Like, that movie it's a Dakota Johnson movie disguised as a Tracy Ellis Ross movie stolen by Kelvin Harrison Jr.
Okay, don't worry. I'm going to watch it. Yeah. I'm going to watch it. I'm going to watch it. I don't know if Brandon wants to review it. I mean, it'll probably be one of those things where we're both going to watch it. It's like, yo, we should do this movie.
Yeah. Brandon said,
you know, because, you know, but it's also, like I said, you know, we were saying on the call the other day, it's like sometimes it's just hard doing movies that, you know, that it's hard to access.
Yeah.
And that's the problem. You know, we want to make sure other people see them so they can, you know.
Well, it's 20 know, bucks. Be, I mean, if you drop 20 bucks, I mean, you could see it.
Yeah, true.
But
true.
Then, like, the Monsters and Men, like, everybody, like, you guys did a great Just Mercy review. The week that we're recording this, you guys, that's your latest episode.
Yeah.
And I enjoyed that one. I would say even Monsters and Men was good. Like, I thought it was great. I rewatched it over the weekend. Mm. And Kelvin Harrison Jr.'s in that, too. Like, that's like what if Eric Garner was shot instead of by the police instead of choked out? And it's from the perspective of, like, three people. Like, the guy that taped the shooting.
Yeah.
Let
me just tell you this.
All right.
The one movie that he did that we're not fans of is It Comes at Night.
I got to rewatch that because I vaguely remember that he was in it until I was like, oh, he was in that.
A fan.
I was kind of I was excited about that, and I just didn't hold my interest. But I am going to watch it again, though. But okay. It's like one of those movies, like, because I watched I would watch Elizabeth Moss read the phone book. She did this. She did this weird ass movie called Shirley, and I was half paying attention to it. But so I gotta rewatch it. But like, yeah, I'm almost like a label whore when it comes to A24. I'm not trying to rhyme, but it just happened.
Yeah.
It's like you kind of got to say, oh, it's A24. It's like the label. It's just like, oh, shit. We'll see what's going on. But I was like, I don't know. All right, Justin. Well, I don't want to hold you too much, man. I know you got to go. Dude, thank you so much. This was fucking great. It's like I've known you.
Thanks for having me, brother.
Yeah, I've known you for a few years, but I was like, I felt like I got to know you a little more.
Well, look at us. We're connecting.
And the audience did too. Hold on to the line for a little bit. So plug even more, like, where to plug the show.
Cool.
And plug anything else you want to plug.
Well, guys, you know, you can find me at Jay Brown Did It on Twitter and Instagram. You can follow the show at Medium P Podcast, Twitter and Instagram. We're on iTunes, Stitcher, Spotify, all of that. Anywhere you can find your podcast, you know, Medium Popcorn. We have one of the most ridiculous, truly ridiculous songs in the game. If you haven't heard it, you got to check it out. Easy Lover, you'll never hear it the same way again. And, you know, we always got some something new coming out every Wednesday.
All right, Justin, thanks so much for doing it. Hold on to the line. Thanks so much for doing it. Everybody, I'll talk to you next time. Take it easy.